Hello, and welcome to Primary Viewpoints from Patient Care Online, a monthly podcast that features informative conversations with healthcare experts, opinion leaders, and practicing physicians about what impacts primary care medicine today. My name is Cindy Jennings, and I am the Associate Editor at Patient Care Online. And in our sixth episode, Grace Halsey, Senior Editor of Patient Care Online, talks with physician mental health expert Michael Myers, MD, Professor of Clinical Psychiatry at SUNY Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York, about the state of physician mental health in the U.S. prior to the COVID-19 pandemic and what impact he witnessed while conducting support groups for healthcare personnel at all levels of patient contact.
Well, before we talk about the COVID-19 crisis, I wonder if you could sort of paint a psychographic for us of what the state of mental health is generally among U.S. physicians these days, or in the before times. We'll talk about before March of this year.
Okay. I'd be happy to do that. What we read, of course, and see in the medical media, of course, is the high index of burnout in today's physicians. And we've been seeing that now for what I'd say almost 20 years. Ballpark figure, 50% of practicing physicians suffer from one or more symptoms of burnout, and it varies from one specialty to another, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the short answer. The longer answer is a little more complicated. I think we're not hearing from a huge cohort of physicians who actually love what they do. They're happy being physicians. But many of them will say, but I'm no more stressed than other hardworking people. We don't have a monopoly on this, that sort of stuff. They that's the way they talk. I also know, of course, that because I interview so many applicants to our medical school, that the applications to medical school are sky high. In fact, they've gone up even to COVID-19. So we know that we must be doing something right, that medical students who are doing preceptorships and shadowing want to become physicians themselves. And the final part that I'll just add to your question has to do with the fact that then there's this other group of doctors, which I'm quite happy to talk about, who have become my patients over the years. And doctors are human too. So we can suffer from anxiety disorders, depression, trouble with alcohol or other drugs, PTSD, things like that, that people in our general society suffer from.
So there isn't anything absolutely about the medical training that creates these stoical figures that we tend to see on television or in other media. Although they are allowed a little more humanity in television these days than they used to be.
Yes, yes, I would agree.
Well, now to talk a little bit more about the pandemic, which really hit the U.S. healthcare system like a tidal wave. And a lot of elements of that system have totally failed. I mean, things as basic as access to protective equipment that let physicians do their jobs day to day. What is it like for physicians, in your experience, living through this kind of a crisis day to day?
It's been really tough. I'm going to tell you what some of the things are. Right in the, as you know, of course, New York City became the epicenter very quickly in late March, April, May, et cetera, of the pandemic. And where I work at SUNY Downstate, our major teaching hospital, University Hospital Brooklyn, was designated a COVID-only hospital by our governor, Governor Cuomo. Right. So basically, then we began to see, you know, many, many patients. The entire hospital then was converted to COVID-only patients. Wow. So what we did in our Department of Psychiatry, we did two things, because we're not on the immediate front lines. What we did is we offered weekly support groups for the hospitalists, for the emergency medicine doctors, for the critical care specialists, et cetera, that whole group. And then we also offered weekly groups too for another group of physicians as well, who were a little bit sort of removed from the front lines, but some of them were redeployed. And then we also had groups, of course, for medical students, for residents. In fact, the resident groups ran 7 days a week. And we had groups for nurses, et cetera, et cetera. But what we were seeing and witnessing in those early days and weeks was just what you said: shock, anxiety, of course, about contagion, about getting it oneself, about contagion to one's own family. Some of our doctors, you know, didn't go home. They would stay in at the hospital or stay in rentals, you know, right on site, and because they really wanted to protect, you know, their family at home. We didn't know that much about it at that time too, and it's contagion, right? The isolation was so difficult. As you know, patients' families were not allowed to be in the hospital, and patients were dying so rapidly. It was really, really awful for our doctors on the front lines. I remember so vividly in our groups how so many of them felt, they felt useless or something, that they really weren't doing anything. Now, I think what that came from was more of almost like an algorithmic approach to medicine. The things that they're used to doing, they didn't have that toolkit. These patients were so sick and dying so quickly. But what my colleague and I reminded them of is that they were basically doing so much for their dying patients by just being present, by communicating with their families through FaceTime, holding the phone up to their ears, by showing them their badge, face, behind all of the protective equipment, basically the humanistic touch of that kind of work at that time. That was sort of it in the early days.
Right.
Exhaustion, fear, of course. Oh, and the beginning, of course, of grieving. So much grieving, which I'm prepared to talk about later if you would like.
Sure. I would think that because of the unprecedented, A, nature, B, scale of this, that even emergency room physicians, I interviewed actually an open heart surgeon from Long Island early on, and his heart transplant OR had been turned into an ICU. And even these guys who really look like Gibraltar were just sort of melting towards the end of a day or towards the end of a week because of the unrelenting A, pace, and B, that sense of I've done everything I can and it still didn't work.
You probably heard of the term moral injury. That's the very important work of two individuals, of Dr. Wendy Dean and Dr. Simon Talbot. And they actually have a whole sort of organization, moral injury site or something like that. But that really fits what so many of the physicians were experiencing, especially situations where perhaps there wasn't enough PPE or where they were having to reuse their dressing gowns or their masks, things like that. They're having to make a decision as to who gets a respirator, having to deal with so many people having so much difficulty breathing on oxygen. When would they get a respirator? And then of course the separation from their loved ones, and if they're not able to be at their bedside and having to stand in for the relatives outside. Those are the kinds of things that Dr. Dean and Dr. Talbot have been really studying. That this is really about a healthcare system that needs revamping. It needs to make major changes so that physicians and other health professionals aren't put into those kinds of conflicts.
Right. I think it's interesting too. I've been thinking as I've watched physicians, nurses, even people who dust to the housekeeping staff in hospitals, that the face, the implacable face that we associate with healthcare providers very often, we've seen it melt on TV. We've seen our healthcare providers begging and pleading with the community to wear masks. We've seen probably nurses and doctors in tears on television. And so even as we say this is a broken healthcare system, we're also seeing a totally different side of our providers. And I'm wondering whether it is affecting healthcare providers to actually see themselves in this light. Is it affecting their sense of efficacy or, I guess, power, professional power? And maybe that's a little bit what you were talking about with the moral injury.
Wonderful question. I think it's a good thing, quite frankly, that this has gotten play in some respects. I think it's our humanness, of course, in the face of tragedy, in the face of a pandemic. And yet, in my mind, it doesn't take away at all from the advanced training, the expertise, integrity, skill, et cetera, of our highly trained frontline health professionals. This is just another piece of them. It's the human part that is expected at one level to absorb what they are facing. Now, of course, this has to be watched though, because individuals still have to have proper rest. They still have to have proper food. They have to make sure that they're getting breaks. They can't be, in a sense, of workhorses. And in fact, many physicians before the pandemic felt that they have been sort of used and abused, that they're just a cog in a wheel.
Right.
And that's been some of the contributing factors to that huge cohort of physicians who have felt burned out and who Dr. Dean and Dr. Talbot would say that's an example of moral injury. Because why some people recoil at the term burnout, because they feel that it blames the health professional, even though it's occupationally induced. And they feel that it's sometimes equated with a sort of lack of resilience, when it's not that at all. It's their inability to really practice their craft in the way that they were trained. In fact, I remember the first couple of weeks hearing a couple of physicians say that the work they were doing in the ICU had actually at one level made them feel better. They said, I was feeling kind of burned out before the pandemic hit, but now I feel I'm doing the work that I'm trained to do. Wish I was saving more lives, but I feel a value that this is, you know, I feel I'm a doctor, I'm a physician.
Yes, and, this is what I was trying to do. So sort of on the flip side of that, we hear and see a fair amount of talk about physicians saying, this is it, I'm leaving medicine. It's been ruined for me. And some feel abandoned, some feel victimized, as I said earlier, by patients who won't follow precautions. Many smaller solo practice or small group practice physicians are actually having to close their doors. I guess this all may add up to the question about PTSD in the wake of the crisis, which is not anywhere near over. And from what you've said, it sounds to me as though there's going to be a group that is resilient, that will move on from this as, and maybe weren't as deeply touched. But for those who were, what do we have to look forward to for them?
Well, what I would suggest in a situation like that, and now I've got my clinician cap on, because when I was in private practice, it wasn't unusual for me at all to have a new patient come and describe exactly sort of what you're saying. It was before the pandemic, but yet, in a sense, you're sort of saying, should I give it all up? I feel like I need to, I want to, et cetera, et cetera. And it became my job to help them sort that out, because what I wanted to make sure of was that they weren't maybe slipping into what we call a clinical depression, a major depression, or some other type of illness that was contributing to the way they were feeling. So in other words, when and if that was the case and we successfully treated it, then their vision and their outlook was quite different.
Right.
They said, you know, now that I'm feeling better, I've got my mojo back. Yes, my work is stressful, but I don't think I need to leave it, or I don't think I need to retire completely. I think I need to make some changes, because so much of this, I think, got me into trouble in the first place, but I'm going to have a second look at that sort of thing. I would suggest that anybody who's considering that would, you know, there are physician coaches out there. They also assist with something like that, you know, because this is often the person's life work, and they want to make sure that if they are going to, others are very clear. they feel done. You know, I've given many years to this. I'm going to retire earlier, and I'm going to become a farmer.
You mentioned earlier the issue of grieving through this process or towards.
Yes.
Why don't you talk about that for a bit?
I will. I think in its largest form, of course, it is people who have been right on the front lines, and they've been sort of grieving just so much death. I heard so many say that I'm used to dying patients, but not so many on one shift. You know, that sort of thing. And also, too, as you know, this is also an illness that has particularly affected minorities and also older individuals as well. And as you do know, not exclusively, though, I mean, it cuts across all ages and all ethnicities, et cetera, et cetera. But even that, though, there's a great sorrow. And there's just a sort of sense of this could be my father, my mother, my grandmother, this kind of thing. In fact, when we lost one of our own, one of our critical care specialists, that was particularly difficult for all of our frontline people. And we also lost a head nurse in our emergency room as well.
Was she the one who was in the national news?
Yeah, no, you may be thinking of Dr. Lorna Breen, the emergency
yes.
physician. Yes, I was. If we have time, Grace, I was just going to mention something about her in a minute, if we could.
Sure.
Yes.
Sure.
But with regard to this, that was a type of grieving as well that really needed to be recognized and really, really allowed and be allowed to happen. And as you mentioned earlier about so many physicians sort of being open, that's what I've witnessed as well, that attending physicians are talking in terms of their vulnerabilities with their trainees. They're just being human. And I think that that's extremely important role modeling. I think they're still respected as the teacher, the supervisor, et cetera, but their humanness is really coming through. The other thing I wanted to mention about mourning, though, is that that's a collective thing. I think the entire world is grieving. We're grieving what once was, you know, the predictability, the sameness, the certainty, and there's been so much uncertainty. As you know, we're all feeling a little bit of hope now with the vaccine, and that's a very good thing. But of course, we still have to remain cautious and all of those sorts of things about masks, et cetera, et cetera. So there is that going on. I've noticed the word loneliness creeping up so much in both the scientific and lay literature. People are feeling just lonely, you know, that we're not allowed to hug each other, we're not allowed to touch.
Yeah.
You know, we can't even, you know, when we've got our masks on, people can't see our smile. Now, maybe they can see our crinkly eyes and things like that. And, you know, we're all missing that.
Yeah. There is a line of thought going through the literature that people who up until March had not had emotional issues or mental health issues. And there may be a huge, huge population of people now desperately needing emotional support of some kind, whether it's through loss of loved ones, loss of employment, loss of, there's so much that can have been lost. And I would think that that would affect, you know, our healthcare professionals as well.
It definitely does. I mentioned earlier at your prompting, Dr. Lona Breen, her death by suicide reached national news when she died while recovering from COVID-19. She contracted herself. She was the head of emergency medicine at the Allen Hospital here, affiliated with Columbia University in New York City.
Right.
And after being off for COVID, came back to work, but was not well. And crashed into a very, very severe depression, and despite treatment, ended her life. But her sister, Jennifer, and her husband, Jennifer's husband, Corey, they have been doing amazing advocacy work in Dr. Lorna Breen's name. Huh. In fact, the Dr. Lorna Breen Healthcare Provider Protection Act, it's a bipartisan bill. It was initiated by Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia. And what it's doing, and this is a very hopeful note because it gets back to what you were asking about earlier, the changes that might need to occur, is that there is now going to be, with passage of this, provisions for the education of our health professionals about well-being, reducing the stigma so that more and more health professionals will go for help. Because there's still that stigma, the hesitancy to go for help. There's going to be much more done in terms of also reducing the fear that doctors have that this could have implications for their medical license, for their malpractice insurance, or their disability insurance. It's a huge bill that will really make a difference. And it really is, it's in honor, of course, of the memory of Dr. Breen, but it is a salute to health professionals all across the country and the important and hard work that they do.
It's interesting in talking with specialists in different disciplines over the last couple of months, many of them have talked about how the pandemic has boosted many or propelled many of the changes that had just begun to take hold or that have been plodding and plodding, like home blood pressure measurement or continuous glucose monitoring, feedback loops, et cetera. All these things that were sort of just moving along have been catapulted. And I bring it up because perhaps the movement, the grassroots movement about the plight of the medical student, the resident who's working double shifts and et cetera, without support. And one of the precursors to that burnout, perhaps this shines a light, the whole issue shines a light on it that will make it less onerous, will help to reduce the stigma, I guess is what I'm saying.
It will. That's right. And see, that gets back to a little bit like what you said earlier about the health being so transparent, their nakedness, their emotional yes. nakedness being, you know, that sort of thing. It's like, you know, we'll be able to, I think they're just, we're all human, doing important work, but we're all human. And so those are the kinds of things that I think are long overdue. And I'm hoping that it'll make it easier for individuals to just reach out for help.
What should my audience, primary care physicians, be looking for or be attuned for in themselves and their colleagues as the pandemic, we hope, winds down? But, you know, there are some tough days still ahead.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Thank you, Grace, for that question. Yeah. I have been preaching and writing for years that, more specifically to medicine, but it occurs across all health professionals, that we must be our brothers and sisters keepers. I know that firsthand because, being a psychiatrist, I know how elusive some illnesses can be. In other words, somebody can be slipping into a problem with alcohol or drug use, or they can slip into a depression and not realize it, that it's actually beginning to affect their well-being, the work that they do, and things like that. So that's why the next step is for all of us, well, to pay attention to our own self and our own symptoms and signs. We need to listen to those loved ones of ours who are concerned about us and reach out to us, our parents, our spouses, our kids, our parents, those kinds of overtures to us that we need to seek some help. And then, of course, each other. And I know we're hearing this so much today. It's very simple. Are you okay? And if you get a dismissive response, I think it's best to follow up with, are you really okay?
Right.
You know,
right.
That kind of thing. And then to create a safe place where an individual can open up a little bit. And then if they could benefit from some help, when we've got resources available to them, we can assist them with that passage. I learned a long time ago, too, that when people are feeling quite ill, it's very hard to make those phone calls to call somebody and ask for help. So yes. I often recommend that you make that phone call. And when I was in practice, I don't know how many phone calls I got from family members or friends of doctors who came to see me. They said, look, I'm an office mate of Dr. So-and-so. She's willing to see you, but she can't make the phone call. Would you be open to seeing her? And I said, absolutely. And then I say, and if you can, if you have the time or can get away, come with her and just wait in the waiting room. That will ease the journey.